Half Price Horror.
Hello and welcome to Half Price Horror, where we get our terror at a discount and pass the savings on to you. Half Price Horror is a spoiler-heavy podcast that takes a deep dive into scary movies curated by the selection at the local Half Price bookstore. I'm your host, John, and today we'll be taking a look at Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare from 1991. Written by Curtis Mayfield and performed by... that's Freddy's Dead with an I-E. This one was written by Rachel Talalay and Michael DeLuca, although as always with the Elm Street movies, there's a lot of uncredited material and writers who pitch stories that were never used, even though elements of their concept wound up in the finished work. And yes, famously, that includes Peter Jackson, director of Braindead and The Frighteners, and oh yeah, the Lord of the Rings movies, who suggested a story that began with Freddy so diminished by all of his defeats that kids take sleeping pills just to dream about beating him up. But we're getting ahead of ourselves a little. The basic idea for this movie came from an unlikely source of inspiration, the box office returns of The Dream Child, which were dismal compared to Part 4. Overexposure, combined with a heavy amount of pressure from parental activists, was finally taking its toll on the Freddy fad. The Freddy's Nightmares TV show was cancelled after its second season despite strong ratings, and it looked like people were finally out of patience with the notion of turning a mass murderer into a family-friendly pop culture icon. New Line decided that it was time to do one last film that would tie up the series once and for all, and maybe give them one last payday along the way. Rachel Talalay, who went on to direct the movie Tank Girl and episodes of pretty much all your favorite genre shows, but who at the time had no experience in the director's chair, lobbied Bob Shaye hard to get a crack at the film. She'd been involved in the franchise pretty much since the beginning in one capacity or another. She was the line producer on Part 3 and a full producer on 4. The difference between those two can be somewhat nebulous, but a line producer tends to be more involved in the day-to-day logistics of the production rather than the creative end. Talalay argued that she deserved her shot, and even though there was still plenty of sexism from the higher-ups to deal with, she got it. And seriously, she has gone on to a hell of a career in television. When I say she directed all your favorite genre shows, I mean she worked on episodes of The Dead Zone, Supernatural, Flash Gordon, Haven, Sherlock, Iron Fist, The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, Supergirl, Doom Patrol, American Gods, Riverdale, Legends of Tomorrow, Superman and Lois, Quantum Leap, and Doctor Who, where she directed all of the Capaldi season finales. It is an amazing resume. Talalay collaborated with Michael Almarieda, one of the screenwriters of the cult classic Cherry 2000, on a screenplay that focused on a grown-up Jacob, Alice's son from Part 5, and his efforts to stop Freddy after the now impossibly powerful dream monster swallowed up the entire town of Springwood into nightmares. But it was deemed both too expensive and too dependent on the continuity of earlier movies, Taron, Joey, and Kincaid all return as quote-unquote dream police that are trying to capture and destroy Freddy, and only a very few elements from it wound up being used. Almarieda lobbied the WGA for a story credit, but was turned down. Michael DeLuca, who we last discussed in the context of his 1994 collaboration with John Carpenter, In the Mouth of Madness, stepped in to perform some rewrites, and you can definitely see a little trace of family ancestry between the two films, but we'll get into that. It was this version that got the green light from Bob Shaye, one that combined the surrealist sensibilities of the then-popular Twin Peaks with a lot more of the comedy that defined the third and fourth installments of the Nightmare series, and a little dash of John Waters' signature outrageousness as well. Talalay got her start working with the legendary provocateur on the 1981 movie Polyester, although the rumor that she brought over John Waters' crew to work on this movie is in fact false. Oh yes, and because this was going to be the last installment, they decided to go all in on the kinds of publicity stunts that Waters himself used to love. Not only was the third act going to be in 3D, but New Line actually held a funeral for Freddy Krueger with many members of the various film's casts in attendance, and they actually got the mayor of Los Angeles to declare September 12, 1991, Freddy Krueger Day. Which didn't exactly go over well with the same people who already hated the glorification of a child murderer in popular culture. After all that, all they needed was a cast. Robert Englund was, of course, back on board as Freddy Krueger, but they decided not to bring back Lisa Wilcox as Alice for a third installment, although she was in some of the drafts, dying at Freddy's hand and passing the torch on to her son. Instead, an entirely new cast was convened, beginning with Sean Greenblatt as John Doe, the last teenager in Springwood. This is probably his most famous role, but he's honestly more famous for his family connections. He's the son of Broadway producers Ken and Sandra Greenblatt, who've won something like 20 Tony Awards between the two of them. And he's the father of Ariana Greenblatt, who's been in Avengers Infinity War, Love and Monsters, In the Heights, Barbie, and the recent Ahsoka series, all before her 16th birthday. It sounds like being a stage dad is a full-time job for him. John Doe, in turn, gets his own cast of one-dimensional teenage friends slash victims, as is tradition for the series by this point, in the form of Leslie Dean's Tracy, Ricky Dean Logan's Carlos, and Brecken Meyer's Spencer. Of the three, Brecken Meyer has gone on to the greatest success, and this is definitely that early horror movie the future star did to get exposure film for him. 4 years later, he'd do the movie Clueless, which broke big, and from there he did The Craft, and Go, and Rat Race, and Garfield, and a ton of voices for Robot Chicken, and became famous for his romantic comedies, even though I have to confess that I always forget he's a real person, because Brecken Meyer sounds like the name a hack screenwriter would come up with for a teen heartthrob in a movie about movies. He's a Minnesota native, by the way. Ricky Dean Logan, meanwhile, is one of those guys who never really broke big, but also never had any problem finding work. He was already an established actor before this, with roles in Back to the Future 2 and 3 as a gang member, and he's popped up in the Tales from the Crypt TV show, Seinfeld and Baywatch, My Name is Earl, ER, and he could have been John in this movie, but he decided he was more interested in Carlos as a character. And again, I know I talk about all the characters in this series being one-dimensional, but I'm mainly talking about the role as written. I've never felt like there's an actor in any of the Nightmare films who isn't trying to do their best with the roles they were given. And that means Leslie Dean is this installment's, wow, is that really your story? Actor. She was already known to New Line from the Freddy's Nightmare series and from working with director Robert Englund on the film 976 Evil, which is, at this point, I think just an honorary Elm Street movie, but she dipped out of Hollywood not long after this movie in favor of a career as a lesbian punk rock musician in the bands Femme to Femme and Scary Cherry and the Bang Bangs. Oh, and she also spent 3 seasons as a roller derby coach for a team called the Slaughterers, part of the Dallas Derby Devils League. She is definitely the cast member I'd most want to hang out with. The other two main cast members are Lisa Zane as Maggie and Yaphet Kotto as Doc, the overworked and underpaid therapists at the youth shelter the kids stay at. Lisa Zane is the older sister to actor Billy Zane of Titanic and, more importantly, Tales from the Crypt presents Demon Knight fame. Look, this podcast has certain priorities. She's a good old-fashioned, hard-working character actor and day player, picking up a ton of voice work on shows like The Incredible Hulk and Iron Man, doing roles in quirky indie genre movies like Monkey Bone, and popping up with guest spots and recurring roles on shows from ER to Judging Amy. You know, the kind of meat and potatoes, get-the-job-done actor this podcast loves. And prior to his death in 2021, Yaphet Kotto was one of our great character actors. We talked about him in Alien, which is probably the single most famous role of his for most horror fans, but other people might know him from 122 episodes of Homicide: Life on the Street as Al Giardello, or the 80s classics Midnight Run and The Running Man, which are two very different movies, believe me, although I'm now thinking of an amalgamation of the two and giggling uncontrollably inside my head, or his turn as James Bond villain Kananga in Live and Let Die. He always lent class and dignity to even the most thankless parts. And believe me, he had his work cut out for him here. And because this was the last official Freddy movie, and remains so, honestly, depending on how you count Freddy vs. Jason, there are some fan theories that that movie takes place before this one, but it doesn't really fit in the timeline very well, honestly. There were plenty of stars who wanted to do cameos. Roseanne Barr and Tom Arnold, who are at this time the height of both their fame and their tempestuous romance, make an appearance as grieving parents in the town of Springwood. This would have been just as the Roseanne TV series was hitting its stride, and she is easily the single most famous person to appear in a Freddy movie as it's being made. Tom Arnold went on to a career as a character actor, overcoming what was at the time a huge stigma associated with nepotism from his more famous wife, while Barr's since gone on to do celebrity cameos and a lengthy career in stand-up prior to getting sucked into the MAGA cult mentality and destroying her entire career with a series of unconscionable jokes about Hitler that have gotten her cancelled in all but the most ultra-right-wing circles. She also did voices for one of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles cartoons. And speaking of shitty cancelled celebrities, Johnny fucking Depp returns for a cameo in this movie. He's hit in the face with a frying pan by Freddy Krueger, making it probably one of the most watchable performances of his career, but he insisted on appearing under the pseudonym Oprah Noodle Mantra, and I think that really speaks volumes about him as a person. Unfortunately, the brain rot only continues with our next celebrity cameo, Alice Cooper, the famous shock rock musician who did the theme song for Friday the 13th Part 6, here appears as Freddy Krueger's stepdad in flashback. Cooper has done numerous cameos, appeared in musicals like the infamous Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and done a metric ton of concert films and music videos, but as he's gotten older, he's also been sucked into the MAGA death cult, and he lost a lot of fans following a transphobic screed he gave in an interview a while back. The Muppets would not approve Alice. Possibly the strangest cameo comes from Eleanor Donoghue, who's most famous from 50s sitcom Father Knows Best and an extended stint on The Andy Griffith Show. Which might not sound like something that would be relevant to an audience of teenagers who would have probably been, negative 15 when those shows aired, but this was the era when Nick at Night introduced a whole new generation of teenagers and young adults to classic black and white television from the 50s and 60s, using ironic marketing to make them seem like a glimpse into the square conformist lives their parents must have led. I know Brian Salisbury of the Junk Food Cinema podcast often talks about the entire section of his brain that's been colonized with obscure details about Dick Van Dyke and My Three Sons, and it's all thanks to this. This being Nick at Night, not the Freddy movies. That would be weird. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that Freddy was played as a child in flashback by Chasen Shimmer and as a teen by Toby Sexton. This was Shimmer's only role, and according to IMDb, he now works in beverage manufacturing, but Sexton still does a lot of work on the stage as well as producing independent movies. Honestly, his scene here with Alice Cooper is probably the best thing about the entire movie, and he's also great in the Never Sleep Again documentary. That covers the majority of the cast, but before we dive in, a brief trigger warning. Although it does not handle its themes with a lot of sensitivity, Freddy's Dead contains depictions of self-harm as well as child abuse, both physical as well as sexual, and animal abuse, and we are going to be talking about those sequences. If this isn't something you feel comfortable with, you may want to listen to a different episode. If you need immediate mental health assistance, you can always call 988 to be connected to crisis counseling for mental health issues. And with that understanding, let's begin. We come in with yet another quote about sleep, this time from Nietzsche, followed by the prime time quote from Part 3 just in case we'd forgotten about the most popular and influential installment of the series. I'll admit, I'm never especially fond of quotes at the front of films, but I'm especially not fond of the double quote to establish us as sneering at our own pretentiousness trope, so from my point of view at least, we're not off to a great start. That said, we do begin with another nice song over the opening titles, I'm Awake Now by the Goo Goo Dolls. This would have been well before their breakout success in the mid-90s, so as is often the case for this franchise, we do get a little look at someone who is about to get famous in a big way. We then get a text crawl over a map of the United States, telling us that we're in Springwood, Ohio, 10 years from now. An odd description of events, because it certainly doesn't look especially futuristic in any sense, but according to IMDb, this is intended to mean 10 years from the release of The Dream Child, i.e. 1999. The crawl says that every single child and teenager in town is dead at Freddy's hands, and the adults are experiencing a collective mass psychosis as a result. There is, according to this omniscient narrator, only one surviving teen left. And I gotta say, I admire the escalation. It's like Phantasm 2, you go from what you think is this small-scale slasher story to something much bigger and more apocalyptic in scope, and I kind of admire that even if I don't think the tone of the movie ever really fits that concept and that subject matter. After the title crawl is finished, we come into the action in an airplane in the middle of a thunderstorm, where one teenage passenger, who obviously is the teenager we were talking about in the title crawl, is deeply uncomfortable with having a seat right over the wing of the plane where he can see the thunderstorm outside. And this is an example of the genuinely tense and interesting direction we get from this movie. Talalay really milks this scene for a lot of ominous dread, and if you have a fear of flying, you're going to be very nervous about little details like the sparks that flare up when his fellow passenger turns on her light, or the tiny streams of water leaking in around the seals in the supposedly pressurized cabin windows. Said passenger is played by Virginia Peters, by the way, and Screen Rant as well as Bloody Disgusting both said that Talalay wrote the part for the infamous drag queen slash performance artist slash John Waters movie star Divine, but he died before they could shoot his appearance. Only Divine actually died in 1988, well before The Dream Child was even released, let alone Freddy's Nightmare, so it certainly couldn't have come as a surprise to Talalay that he wasn't available for a role in the sixth film. I have actually confirmed with Talalay on Twitter that this rumor was nonsense and that Divine was never considered for this part. In any event, the plane comes apart in midair and our mysterious teen plummets down toward the ground only to wake back up in his own bed. But it's a double dream fakeout and the house turns out to be also falling from a tremendous height straight toward the ground. Which is a nice little opening, and I was fully prepared to wonder why this is such an unpopular installment. And then Freddy shows up outside the window, riding a broomstick and sporting a hat and cloak straight out of The Wizard of Oz, saying, "I'll get you, my pretty, and your little soul, too." And I understood. Because look, it's not like it's been especially easy to take Freddy seriously as a threatening villain for a while now. Between the three installments that preceded this and the two seasons of Freddy's Nightmares where he acted as a jovial horror host, he's become something of a camp icon, and you have to admit that in order to make any kind of sense out of this franchise. But this is a movie that starts with the premise that Freddy has finally murdered every last possible victim in his native stomping grounds, that he's desperate to find a way past the boundaries of Springwood, and that he is going to once again prey on the darkest fears and anxieties of a group of troubled youths who are, as with Part 3, treated with carceral institutionalization by a callous and overworked system. This is an entire movie that depends on Freddy's absolute, heartless, evil as its linchpin, and it starts right off with the wicked Freddy of the West and only gets sillier from there. It frankly undermines the entire film. The teen, who never gets a name other than John Doe, so let's just start calling him that now, survives the fall and goes tumbling out of the window to find himself right next to the infamous Elm Street house. He wisely runs the other direction, falling down a steep hill in a sequence that really just made me feel very sorry for the poor actor who probably had to do several takes of it, and comes out near the road leading out of town. And one of the things I do give Freddy's Dead credit for is the way that John feels like a legit survivor of all of these rampages, always doing the smart thing instead of following dream logic straight into Freddy's traps. Oh, hey, there's a dilapidated and creepy house with a little red tricycle parked on the front porch? Let me go as far away from that as possible. John gets a ticket on the next bus out from a teller played by Bob Shea in a hammy, over-the-top performance that reminds me of the people working in local roadside attractions who maybe don't get that they can scale their creepy menace down to an 8 or even a 7 and still convince people that something spooky is about to happen. John doesn't take the ticket, but it doesn't matter because the bus slams straight into him, driven by Freddy himself in a callback to Part 2, and knocks him all the way past the city limits where he comes to rest in broad daylight with his head smacking against a rock. Freddy, who seems to be unable to cross the boundary between the nightmarish world of Springwood and the outside universe, tells him to be a good doggy and go fetch. And I know I'm not the first person to point this out, but this is a movie about a nightmarish town where an otherwise all-powerful eldritch entity with the ability to rewrite reality is trapped, and the protagonist is sent out of town on a bus with the key to freeing it so it can overrun the entire world and infect the universe with its evil, and it's written by Michael DeLuca, screenwriter of In the Mouth of Madness. I'm not saying he ripped himself off, but there are definitely some interesting themes in common between the two. John wakes up, dazed and confused, and starts wandering in the direction of the next town over. which seems to be some sort of urban hellscape with massive air pollution and decaying warehouses and graffiti everywhere. I think one of the biggest problems with this movie, apart from the central clash in tone, is that the people who are making it don't really have any authentic connection to the material they're working with, and so it's really just a reflection of the movies and TV shows they watched about crime-blighted cities, which are in turn reflections about what those writers saw on television, and so on, until the world's least convincing stoner is being lectured about personal responsibility by a Donald Trump impersonator in a building that's supposed to be a youth shelter for troubled teens, but looks more like the offices of a local Greenpeace chapter. I think the film would have been much better served if they'd abandoned this entire angle, because they just can't do it convincingly. The stoner is Spencer, by the way, and the Trump impersonator is Spencer's father, played by Michael McNabb, and seriously, I defy you to look at him and not think of what would have been one of the most famous businessmen of the 80s. It's very deliberate, and a little cringeworthy in light of where we wound up with America's most notorious would-be dictator, but obviously they couldn't have anticipated that in 1991. Spencer's therapist Maggie comes in while he's talking with his dad, and we get a brief scene that establishes her sympathetic nature and ability to rap with the kids, and then the administrator comes in brandishing a pipe bomb he found in Spencer's room like it's a contraband firecracker and not an improvised explosive device that could very easily kill the person holding it if detonated prematurely. It's the problem we've been having with the entire franchise since Part 3 in Microcosm. This is actually a very serious situation. It's a literal bomb threat, but it's treated like a wacky comedy prank. The administrator puts the pipe bomb downstairs with the rest of the arsenal the inmates have improvised, and I'm presuming that each and every gun was confiscated from Chekhov because you couldn't have a more obvious setup for the third act. We meet one other member of the ensemble here, as Tracy comes in chased by two cops who want to arrest her for fighting, but who back down when Maggie says Tracy reacts violently to being touched. And then we cut over to an alley where two cops see John Doe taking no-dos out of an instinctual desire to stay awake as much as possible, and decide to just dump him at the shelter rather than process him. They say they don't want to deal with the paperwork, but actually, cops love doing paperwork. It's an easy way to make overtime money doing nothing but writing a report. We then jump back to the shelter, or rehab facility, or halfway house, or whatever it actually is, because, again, the people writing this movie don't seem to have much familiarity with any institution of this kind, and so it kind of wavers back and forth between a lot of the tropes of all three, where Tracy is working out on a punching bag held by Carlos. We pretty quickly get everyone's assigned character traits laid out in a scene full of rote exposition. Tracy is violent and doesn't like men. Carlos is deaf and, look, if you thought the characterization of Will in Part 3 was ableist and shallow, you just watch Carlos limbo under that bar. And of course, we saw Spencer as a stoner who blows things up because his daddy doesn't pay attention to him. Although, really, you could not find someone more miscast as a stoner than Brecken Meyer. He looks like he stepped straight out of a live-action Disney show. The three of them are planning to stow away in the facility's ancient van, where one of the staff has agreed to drive them away so they can head for California and get out from under their respective horrible families and institutionalization, which is, again, not the purpose of a youth shelter, and they're treating it like they're stuck there, but a shelter is for people who don't have anywhere else they can go, and it's usually a voluntary stay, so this doesn't make a whole lot of sense. There's a bit of bickering between them that drops the heavy-handed hint that Tracy was abused by her father, and even though it's all a bit broad and clunky, I will say that Dean plays it with a lot of sincerity and honesty, and I think I would have liked the film a bit more if they'd made her the protagonist and took her situation seriously. But they don't, so we cut to Doc, and I feel so sorry for Yaphet Kotto and Lisa Zane, because this is just another nakedly expositional scene handled so clumsily that I almost feel like they're handing me cliff notes for the rest of the movie. Doc is a dream therapist who's making progress despite the impossible caseload at the shelter, even though we only really see four kids the entire time they're there, and who's convinced he can handle Maggie's recurring nightmares if she'd only let him. But Maggie's more interested in the new poster on his wall, which he says depicts ancient dream demons that, according to legend, roamed the dreams of the living until they could find a twisted and evil soul for them to empower with the ability to blur the lines between dreams and reality. Which is, I'm sure, entirely unrelated to this movie, and I'm glad they took the time to flesh out Doc's character by showing his interest like this. Maggie's called away to investigate the John Doe who is brought in with amnesia, and she diagnoses him not with head trauma, even though we saw him smack skull first into a large rock, and even though he's got a bandage over a cut on his head, but with unspecified emotional trauma. And I'm certainly not going to suggest that it would be impossible in real life for someone who had real physiological symptoms of a head injury to be treated like a drug addict by a callous and indifferent system, but Maggie's supposed to be our actual hero here. She's supposed to care. Having her be this incompetent this early really feels like a misstep that the writers went along with simply out of convenience. Plus, I feel very sorry for Sean Greenblatt in this scene, who has to go from cracking jokes to big emotional outbursts with zero ramp-up, and winds up looking really hammy as a result. John has a newspaper clipping on him about a missing Springwood woman, and Maggie examines it while John sings 4,567 bottles of beer on the wall in the dormitory to stay awake. Maggie falls asleep at her desk and dreams of herself as a little girl playing tag with her dad, and we see that same child in John's dream when he finally gives up and falls asleep. He goes sleepwalking, and we see him actually ascending thin air as he follows the girl through the Elm Street house, even though he's outside of Springwood and Freddy's power doesn't extend this far, and it's probably a good idea to forget about any of the rules established in the previous installments because they don't really apply them here. John wakes up, realizing the key to his nightmares and amnesia lie in Springwood, and Maggie decides to take him back to see if she can jog his memory despite his protests. And of course, Carlos, Tracy, and Spencer choose that moment to stow away in the back of the van, which is revealed when a dozing John tries to take the wheel to avoid running over the little girl he sees in the road, and they skid to a screeching stop. Maggie's not happy to find the teens midway through an escape attempt, but she decides to bring them into town and help them find a phone. They stop off at the town fair, and this is one of the moments where Talalay creates some convincingly creepy atmosphere. With all the children in town dead, the adults are simply acting out the motions of entertaining kids without any rhyme or reason to their actions. And one couple, played by Tom and Roseanne as mentioned, actually accost the teens to try to take them for their own. Unfortunately, the screenwriters simply forget that Tracy gets violent when someone touches her, so we're not treated to the spectacle of Leslie Dean beating the crap out of Roseanne. Such a shame. The phones are out of order, so Maggie hands over the keys to the van to the three minors who are currently trying to break out of a mental health facility and tells them to drive back because apparently she's big on the honor system or something. They quickly discover that the internal geography of Springwood prevents them from leaving, though, in another scene that bears strong similarities to In the Mouth of Madness and does have some effective creepiness to it. Honestly, I'd say the waking sequences are far more unnerving and effective than the dream sequences in this movie, which feels weird for an entry in the Nightmare series, but here we are. Oh, and if you want proof that this is an entry written by people with absolutely no connection to the culture they're writing about, Carlos at one point calls Spencer a quote-unquote hi-yo for smoking marijuana. Given the company's famous connection with Reefer Madness, you'd think someone from New Line would have stepped in and checked this dialogue, but nope. The sequence also contains one of the best dream moments in the movie, although I think it would probably be a little lost on modern audiences. When Tracy asks Carlos for the map, he's already beginning to doze off, and his efforts to unfold it turn into a bewildering origami nightmare as it unfolds and unfolds and unfolds to fill the entire cargo area, only to show him the words, "You're fucked," in bloody letters when he finally does find Springwood. These days, everyone has GPS, and nobody needs to deal with those huge, clunky paper maps, so it's not quite as relatable as it would have been in 1991, but it's still an effectively cool moment. Maggie and John, meanwhile, go to the local school, where they discover a teacher played by Matthew Faison, who's obviously suffering from some kind of psychosis, teaching the class on Freddy 101 to an empty classroom. And weirdly, this is probably the best way to handle this exposition dump in the whole series. It's creepy and entertaining at the same time, it covers the lore in a fresh and interesting way, and it holds the audience's attention when so many of these lore dumps are a good time to go and grab popcorn. And this one contains a real revelation. Before he died, Freddy Krueger had a child, who was sent to a local orphanage after he murdered his wife and mysteriously disappeared. This causes a lot of complications in his backstory because you'd think they'd be able to convict him of killing Loretta Krueger even if they couldn't get him for all the kids, and if he was acquitted, it's hard to imagine he wouldn't get back custody of his own child because the legal system can't just say, well, we know you did it anyway, so we're not letting you exercise your parental rights. But once we got to, they said she hung herself, but they never found the body, I think we are past complaining about any of the Freddy lore. As night falls, and Tracy, Carlos, and Spencer are unable to find a way out of Springwood, they decide to squat in an abandoned house for the night. It turns out to be the Elm Street house in disguise, which is just the weirdest and most inexplicable little touch, even if I do like the imagery of the house transforming as soon as they go inside. But I mean, it's not as though any of them would even know what house it is, so why bother disguising it? In any event, they settle in for some good old-fashioned Freddy-themed nightmares. In Carlos's dream, we see how he lost his hearing. He winds up in a very stereotyped tenement building where his mother, played by Angelina Estrada, slaps him and brandishes a Q-tip at him. She transforms into Freddy and pushes it in until it comes out the other side, which doesn't kill him because insert shrug emoji here. Freddy then cuts off his ear and the hearing aid along with it, and I kind of feel like you can tell how ableist this movie is by the way Carlos has lost hearing in both ears but only has a hearing aid in one. It's something they could have checked with a 5-minute phone call to a local doctor, even in 1991, but they just didn't make it a priority, and I think that's a problem. Carlos flees Freddy, and the film goes silent apart from the sound of his breathing to reflect his experiences as he runs through the boiler room with Freddy in taunting pursuit. This isn't Yeager's makeup, by the way, it's David B. Miller back again from the first film, and I'm not sure whether they simplified the appliance to make it easier to wear for Robert Englund, or if they just made some different artistic decisions, or if it was a budgetary thing, but it really looks fake this time out. It looks like Robert Englund wearing a Freddy Krueger Halloween mask, which just adds to the campy artificiality of the scares and makes it even harder to take the movie seriously. Freddy finally gives Carlos his hearing aid back, but it grows directly into his ear in a nasty and very effective body horror moment, and gives him hearing so sensitive that even the sound of dripping water causes him physical pain. Krueger then drops pins onto the metal floor to torment his victim, and finally kills him by scraping his claws back and forth across a portable blackboard until Carlos's head explodes. It's actually a very convincing effect, but I think it would have worked better on an emotional level if, well, if we knew anything about Carlos, but also if they'd gone with him scraping his claws on the metal railings in the boiler room like we've already seen him do in so many movies. Not to reiterate, but the campiness of the deaths really takes away from their impact. This one's dad joke, "Nice hearing from ya, Carlos." We then cut to Tracy, who's looking for Carlos but can't find anyone but Spencer. He's watching a broken television because apparently the makers of this movie have confused weed with LSD, even though I have to imagine they've at least tried marijuana themselves. And as she storms out, we see the scene from Spencer's perspective and discover that he's watching Carlos warn him not to fall asleep. Maggie and John, meanwhile, are over at the orphanage trying to find out what happened to Freddy's child, and John has come to the conclusion that he must be the kid in question, even though they would have been born in 1964, making them about 35 when this movie is set. He tries to get the orphanage worker to confirm his theory, but she recognizes everyone as a former ward of hers, real or imaginary, so it kind of falls flat. All we learn from the child's drawing Maggie finds of a happy family is that their name begins with a K and they don't look anything like a little girl with pigtails, so the filmmakers aren't playing fair with the audience because they don't want anyone guessing the twist. In fairness, I thought John was Krueger's child the first time I watched it, but that was mainly because I didn't think the filmmakers had enough respect for my intelligence to put in anything as complex as a red herring. Tracy takes the van to go after Maggie and John and catches up with them just as they're leaving the orphanage. The three of them go back to the Elm Street house, but while they're away, Spencer sees Johnny Depp on the broken television set reenacting the famous This Is Your Brain on Drugs ad from 1987. This was famously an ad where a man played by John Roselius held up an egg and said, "This is your brain," then cracked it into a hot frying pan and tilted it to the camera saying, "This is your brain on drugs," as it fried. He then said, "Any questions?" I don't know why they picked Johnny Depp for it, apart from his previous connection to the franchise, but as Freddy promptly hits him with a frying pan and he stops being in the movie, I can safely say it's my favorite appearance of his ever. Always remember, Johnny Depp is a wife beater, and you can say that without fear of legal repercussions because the truth is an absolute defense against libel, and this has been proven in court. A river of psychedelic colors then flows out from the television, engulfing Spencer, and I have to admire the production for splashing out to get the actual Inagata De Vida from Iron Butterfly for this sequence, even though they yet again confuse marijuana for a hallucinogen. Spencer is sucked into the TV and winds up in a video game where Freddy alternates between playing Spencer and his antagonist because it's pretty clear the people making this movie weren't exactly experienced with video games and didn't quite know how to focus the analogy beyond having Freddy say things like, "Now I'm playing with power," and "Great graphics." It's not a very visually interesting sequence, and sadly it takes up a lot of the film's runtime. Maggie goes into the backyard looking for Spencer and sees the vista from her dreams of childhood, so I guess it took us 3 installments for the production team to fully forget that the Elm Street house is Nancy's old home and not Freddy's, but when Spencer comes crashing through the window into the dining room still trapped in his dreams, she puts that revelation on hold to try to wake him up. But Spencer's lethargy is at least in part chemically induced, so there's no getting him out of his dreams early, and with no other options, John decides to go into Spencer's dreams to save him before he gets killed by Freddy's control. There is a sequence where Breckenmeyer is forced to act out being controlled by Freddy, punching walls and jumping like a video game character, complete with cartoon sound effects and bug-eyed reaction shots from Maggie, and it would not surprise me if his friends play it for him anytime he starts bragging about being a Hollywood big shot, because ouch, this is embarrassing. John goes into Spencer's dream by goading Tracy into knocking him out, and Tracy goes in by lucid dreaming herself there because she's been working with Doc, and it's apparently also taken us 3 installments to forget that sharing dreams was a special gift unique to Kristen that she then bequeathed to Alice in the sequel, and not just something anyone could do if they put their mind to it. There are some fan theories that John Doe is actually Jacob, Alice's son from the Dream Child, and he shares her powers, but that doesn't explain why Tracy was simply able to will herself into the shared dream without John's knowledge. The two of them find Freddy just hanging out and playing his Kill Spencer game, and they steal his controller, but he uses his... sigh... power glove to finish the teen off. The Power Glove was a 1989 accessory for the original Nintendo Entertainment System, one that used prototype VR technology to track hand position and movements, and in theory allow you the same kind of motion-based video game control you'd later see in things like the Wiimote and Xbox's Kinect. However, it worked horribly, being very imprecise in its tracking, and people mostly just used the standard Nintendo controller built onto its wrist. It's mostly famous now as a piece of pop culture kitsch, used in the movie The Wizard by the film's villain, leading to the line, "I love the Power Glove. It's so bad." Also, everyone says that Nintendo refused New Line permission to use the peripheral in the movie, and that Bob Shea went ahead with it anyway, which ignores the blatant fact visible on screen that what Freddy uses isn't a power glove. It's a vaguely similar mock-up that Freddy calls his power glove, because even in dreams, we are not free from intellectual property laws. Spencer falls to his death in both the game and real life, which Freddy responds to by saying, "Well, what do you know? I beat my high score," and laughing endlessly at his own cleverness. I've already talked about how tonally inconsistent the constant dad jokes are when placed against the heavier material in the story, but it's also worth noting how unfunny they are and how forced and irritating Freddy's loud, raucous belly laughs are in response to them. Never trust a comedian who laughs at their own jokes. Tracy fights Freddy, but Maggie wakes her up before anything can happen, and the two of them drag John's unconscious body to the van. They drive out of town, the disorienting effects of the local geography gone now that Maggie is driving again, and in his dream, John finds himself once again in his own bed in his own room. And in what is a legitimately funny joke among all the clumsy enforced comedy, he refuses to leave it because he knows all the ways Freddy will get him if he does, and with note-perfect timing, the bed catches fire. I straight up love that gag. John, of course, feels comfortable leaping out of the window and falling endlessly toward the ground, because he knows he's Freddy's kid and Daddy won't do anything to hurt him, and the parachute he finds on his back convinces him that he's right. But Freddy cuts the straps, taunting him that he only let John live so he could bring Freddy back his daughter, and John plummets directly onto a bed of spikes Freddy pushes out into the street below him, and we get the death of the falsest false protagonist ever. He has just enough time to tell Maggie, "It's not a boy," before he dies and his body dissipates into smoke that flows into Freddy's chest. Freddy then flows directly into Maggie's brain, their connection allowing him to escape Springwood inside her because ... and the two survivors head out of town the way they came. And okay, I will give DeLuca and Talalay some credit. This makes emotional sense, even though it relies on several new rules for Freddy's powers and abilities that aren't established anywhere but here. We've never been told that Freddy could go into any dreaming child in Springwood, we've never been told that he's trapped within the boundaries of Springwood, and we've certainly never been told that he can escape by traveling through the living mind of one of his relatives. But the way this story shows us those rules is credible and convincing. Credit where it's due, I'm not too bugged by this plot clutch. Even though it could all have been avoided by using Wes Craven's original idea for part 3. Back at the rehab facility, Maggie is stunned to find out that nobody remembers Carlos or Spencer's existence, which neatly closes the major plot hole of why there's a town within walking distance that's had its entire child and teen population murdered and no one ever discusses it. Freddy excised them completely from memory, so to everyone else, Springwood is just that town full of people who share the delusion that they all used to have kids. Only Doc still remembers because he has the ability to lucid dream, so maybe he knows about the real Springwood but just gave up on trying to explain it to people because there's only so much you can say about it before you get locked up in a mental institution yourself? That's my best guess, at least. Maggie takes a moment to ponder John's dying words and decides to go to her mom's house and do a little research. Sure enough, she's adopted, and she's just the right age to be the daughter of Fred Krueger during the time frame in question. And that night in her dreams, we get the expository flashback to prove it. Little Catherine Krueger was playing tag in the backyard with her dad when her mom Loretta, played by Lindsay Fields, emerges from the cellar screaming. Fred sends Catherine inside so that he can have a little talk with just the grown-ups in the family. But he's a bit preoccupied and doesn't notice that his kid is going into the same room his wife just left. And inside. Let me just say that I love this scene, and I really wish it had been in a movie that did it full justice, because the set designers and prop artists really went all out. There's a whole shelf of prototype Freddy gloves, some with hooks at the fingertips, and others with wicked spikes on the knuckles, as well as clippings about the child murderer on the loose in Springwood and jars with human remains. And while I do think that a killer like Freddy would have had difficulty maintaining normal relationships, and it's hard to imagine him as a family man, the fact is that there are serial killers out there who've had wives and kids who never knew about the darkness hidden within the heart of one of the people they most loved. This is the seed of a really interesting movie that could have legitimately turned the franchise on its head. But because it's this movie, we instead get a very campy monologue where Freddy explains to Maggie that he killed all the kids in town as revenge for having his own child stolen, which is something like the third motivation they've given him in this series, and none of them work, because the reason he killed those kids is that he liked killing kids, and in fact child murder was the activity he was engaged with that led all those people into conflict with him in the first place. It's like having a car thief who steals your car, and when you repossess it, he says, "Oh, as revenge for having my car stolen, I will steal all your cars!" My dude, you were going to do that anyway. As if to prove my point, he says that now he's free, he's going to kill all the kids in the world, one by one, starting with the kids in the shelter, because, quote, "every town has an Elm Street." Which I gotta say raises the stakes quite nicely, even if this movie isn't really up to handling them. And nothing demonstrates that more than the way Tracy is suddenly trapped in a dream where her dead father comes home and makes several disgusting and blatantly sexual remarks to her that leave you with absolutely no doubt that she was molested as a little girl. Apparently, this scene was very tough for Leslie Dean, who was repressing some real trauma related to her own abuse as a child. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying you can't do a scene like this that touches on the awful reality of child sexual abuse. There's a real place for this in horror. But you can't do it in the same movie where your ostensible monster dresses up like Margaret Hamilton and cackles, "I'll get you, my pretty, and your little soul, too." There's just too much of a disconnect here between tone and content that risks disrespecting some very serious emotional material. The characters of Tracy and Maggie deserve to be the center of films that were honest about what they were going through instead of deflecting with humor, and it's a shame they got what they did because this does not work, and it legitimately could have. Tracy beats her dream father back to death with an electric kettle, then beats Freddy when he reverts to his true form. Apparently, Dean suffered some real injuries in this sequence that required stitches. But Freddy just keeps getting up, so she burns herself to wake up, so apparently that lucid dreaming thing only works one way, and she and Maggie go to find Doc while he too dreams of Freddy in a scene that wants to be a contest of wills between two equals, but really can't be because they haven't given Doc enough screen time or interesting material to carry it, despite Yaphet Kotto's amazing charisma. He does get to beat Freddy with a baseball bat, though. In fact, Freddy gets the crap knocked out of him a lot in this third act, which, as with the first movie, really diminishes his threat at exactly the moment the film needs him to be at his scariest. Freddy tells Doc he can't be killed in dreams, no matter what methods people have come up with over the years, and Doc responds by grabbing a piece of his sweater and waking up to reestablish what we learned back in the very first movie. You can bring Freddy out of dreams and back into a reality where he's vulnerable. Which didn't work in the very first movie, but on the other hand, oh look, a squirrel. He sends Maggie into a lucid dream to drag Freddy out, giving her a pair of 3D glasses that he says will act in the dream world as perception enhancers to let her see through Freddy's many illusions, and I feel like that could have made sense if they'd spent a little time setting it up with a quick, "Oh, I'm going to hypnotize you to sleep, and the power of the suggestion will make these glasses do this," but instead it's just unsupported and illogical and really only serves to introduce the 3D gimmick that New Line made such a big deal of in theaters. Apparently it failed badly. Very few audience members understood that they were supposed to put their own glasses on when Maggie put on hers, so it really just seemed like the film suddenly became blurry in Act 3. Maggie falls asleep and puts on the glasses, and of course we get a ton of those cheesy move random things directly at the camera moments that you get with 3D movies in this era because everyone wants to make sure the audience gets their money's worth out of it, and Maggie goes through the door in Doc's poster guarded by dream demons that unfortunately look just a tiny bit too Muppety to be scary. It's the big eyes and the wide mouths and the faintly mournful expressions. They're straight out of Jim Henson's The Storyteller to me. Inside Freddy's brain, Maggie short-circuits some of his synapses with a gold bracelet to gain access to his memories, which confused me to no end because it wasn't set up in this movie at all, but there was a scene in last episode's film Zader where a character is presented with a gold bracelet, so I found myself wondering if this wasn't foreshadowed in an Italian conspiracy thriller from 1983. Inside, she sees a young Freddy killing the school's pet gerbil with a hammer right in front of the whole class, who respond inexplicably by taunting him with the chant, "Son of a Hundred Maniacs," over and over again. And I think you could legitimately make a prequel to the Freddy series that follows him from childhood and shows his cruelty developing, but it's not something you can pull off in the last 15 minutes of a movie that's already a tonally inconsistent mess. Maggie next sees Freddy as a teen cutting himself with a straight razor and laughing, shortly before his stepfather shows up to beat him with a belt and discovers to his dismay that Freddy no longer cares about pain. And incidentally, one of the few things I do like about this sequence is that it plays on things we saw in the very first movie, where Freddy doesn't care about inflicting injury on himself and in fact does it on purpose to unnerve others. That's a nice touch, I gotta admit. Freddy makes a gesture with the straight razor, sending it directly at the camera in what I think is supposed to be Freddy murdering his stepdad, but which is so ineptly staged that it really does look like he's just showing off his new toy. I can't blame Talalay for that, of course, at least not entirely, because as with Friday the 13th Part 3, the 3D effects are so difficult to work with that it's hard to stage anything organically. But it doesn't look convincing. We then get the night Freddy was murdered, where the dream demons come to him and promise him immortality and the chance to continue his killing spree eternally, and not to harp on it, but as the climax of a film all about this, with those creatures given some real time and thought and production work to make them look like anything but sperm with faces, this could perhaps have come off as something other than silly. But as rushed as it is, I think I can safely say that it's laughable. And Maggie then sees her child self seeing her father killing her mother, and in this one moment, you can kind of see the potential of the whole story as England drops the camp for one scene and brings genuine menace. But that's gone quickly as Maggie grabs Freddy and drags him out into the real world, where for some reason he appears down in the basement instead of in her arms. Because that's where the contraband is, and we need some cool weapons for the final battle because there's no longer any neat dream imagery to work with. When Maggie finds Freddy, he's at first free of makeup, and he tries to explain to her that he loves her and he had no real options in life because of his brutally abusive upbringing, which is the kind of awkward conversation nobody wants to have about any serial killers, so instead Maggie just knocks the glove off his hand and it comes flying straight at the camera in another unintentionally hilarious 3D bit. She picks it up, and the two of them fight. Freddy tries to strangle her, but she headbutts him before slashing him with his own blades. He tries to grab his glove back, but she bites his nose and then breaks his fingers with a joke about holding hands with him back when she was a kid? The dialogue in all this is so weird and tonally off-kilter for the scene's content. Both of them are making wisecracks when she just discovered that her dad murdered her mom and he's fighting for his life, and I really feel like part three did a disservice to the whole franchise by convincing everyone that this was the aesthetic to aim for. Doc and Tracy, who are trapped outside the room, slide a series of weapons through the wire fencing to Maggie, and she demonstrates those expert knife-throwing skills we saw earlier by pinning Freddy to the wall with a series of pinpoint dagger tosses. You remember the knife skills, right? The ones that explain why she's suddenly so good at hand-to-hand combat with all these different weapons? Maybe Freddy murdered that scene and only lucid dreamers remember it. Or maybe this is just following Chekhov's old axiom. If you want to show someone firing a gun in the third act, you must show them loading it in the first. But knives? Fuck that, man. Everyone's good with knives. With Freddy pinned in place, Maggie puts on the glove, and there's a weird scene where Freddy tells her how much she'll like using it because violence is in her blood that fits in with literally nothing else in the movie and was apparently intended as a seed for a spin-off if this film did well. It didn't, or at least not well enough to get Maggie's Alive the next nightmare or whatever they would have called it, but apparently someone picked up on this foreshadowing because she does turn evil in the Freddy vs. Jason vs. Ash comics published by Wildstorm. But here she just stabs him in the stomach with his own blades, takes Chekhov's pipe bomb and shoves it into the open wound, and quips, "Happy Father's Day," before running away. Freddy in turn quips, "Ugh, kid." Before exploding, because there's not a single moment this film can allow to have actual dramatic heft, and Freddy's head does a weird Hong Kong triple take as it flies out at the camera in gratuitous 3D. And if you don't mind my shouting out fellow podcasters Podmortem, there's a joke they always make whenever the title of a movie is mentioned within the movie where they say the line and then quip, "Roll credits," and that made this ending even more risible to me because the last scene of the film is Lisa Zane looking almost directly into the camera and saying, "Freddy's dead." And then they roll credits. God, they're gonna have a field day with this if they ever do it for their show. And that's that. The credits roll over a montage of greatest hit scenes from the previous five movies, and the Iggy Pop song Why Was I Born, which was written for this movie, and the franchise grinds to a somewhat ignominious halt. Freddy's Dead made a profit, like all of the films in the series, but not nearly enough of one to consider backtracking on the decision to make it the last installment, and it wouldn't be until 2003's Freddy vs. Jason that we'd see a full movie in continuity return for the character. That's not to say we're done with Freddy, though, but the next steps in this story involved one of the most unlikely returns in the franchise's history. And I don't mean Heather Langenkamp. And will I hang on to this movie? Again, it's a moot point, because I have a full box set and there's no real gain to be had in splitting it up, but if this was its own DVD with its own case and I had to make the decision whether to hang on to this or let it go, I'd drop it in a heartbeat and it wouldn't even be a difficult decision. It's a horror comedy that isn't funny and isn't scary, and all of the things that it could have done well, it instead decided to ignore in favor of clumsy camp and more of the spooky carnival aesthetic I already disliked. There are a very few scenes I'd watch again, but that's what YouTube is for, and in many ways, this is the YouTuber's horror franchise. Whenever you think of the great Freddy moments, it's always scattered scenes and never a story or a plot. So, while this is on the shelf, it's not in my heart. Sorry, Freddy. And if you want to talk about tonal inconsistencies, Freddy Krueger as the Wicked Witch of the West, or about anything else that came up on this podcast, you can find me on Twitter as @halfhorror, and on Tumblr, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd as Half Price Horror. My watch list on Letterboxd contains everything I plan to tackle in future episodes. If there's something you'd like to hear about, let me know. You can also support the show at patreon.com/halfpricehorror, and you can rate and review me on Apple Podcasts and anywhere else this podcast is found. And next time on Half Price Horror, well, I said in my episode on Silent Hill that I really wanted to track down the sequel and see if it deserved the bad press it got, and apparently my family was listening because guess what I got for Christmas? That's right, it's Silent Hill Revelation from 2012, and we're all going to discover it together. See you then.